Hey, pronouncers, welcome back to the podcast. We've got a really special episode a little bit later, but we've got a pretty exciting pre-show here. 20-minute pre-show. I'm boxing it in a little bit more this time because I feel like this can go off into another hour, and then it's a little bit long. Anyway.
Aren't we entertaining, Bruce?
I think
you just wanted to
Is it because
cut
they give you a hard time about what printing things you don't know? Is that why you're cutting
fountain?
It short?
Can yeah, we start with that today?
Yeah, let's start
Split
with the beat up Bruce first five.
On this new part of email podcast at Printavo, if you'd like to ask Bruce a technical question about printing, he will do his best to answer it live as best he can, and we will critique in Olympics. We'll give you a score.
But you got to send it straight to me or Steven so Bruce doesn't know about it and have time to do the research first.
Matt@printavo.com.
There you go.
Or steven@campus.inc.com.
Yep. So, Bruce, what are we going to talk about today?
Okay. I'm going to just jump in real quick with the... I got two things, actually, that I want to talk about. Number one, obviously, if you haven't gotten your tickets, they are almost sold out for Print Hustlers Conf, October 22nd, 23rd. Really exciting this year. I hope we don't have any of this Delta problems just with regulations and things changing, but we're watching it. But you can reserve it. Of course, you can always cancel your room or whatever if worst comes to worst. But the speakers are stacked. They're done. We're going to start announcing them later in the week. I don't know when this is going to come out, but you guys will see it. And so it's actually really diverse. It's the most diverse speaker set outside the industry and inside the industry. Super pumped about that. All right. First thing is ask anything. You guys can write in podcast@printavo.com to be able to ask any sort of problem that you are currently having. This one comes from Tracy Stearns out of Running Threads.
Woo, Tracy.
Hey, Tracy.
This is Matt's account. They're out of Arkansas. She wrote in a really good question, and Farag, I feel like this is almost directed towards you. Sorry, Matt. She says, I'd be interested in hearing about different pricing structures for stores and fundraising stores, short-term stores, aka Greek. I've been doing pricing by total quantity sold, but really want to get a set amount made/order for the group, like $5 a shirt that may go up to $8 if they sell more. Just how do I do pricing? How do I price? And it sounds like it's a really more of a getting started, an intro to pricing, less of how complex you've gotten with, your diverse clientele. That's a thick question.
It's got a lot of meat on the bones. so I've actually simplified our pricing quite a bit when it comes to online stores, and it all comes down to risk. When you build an online store, you assume all the risk. You are essentially setting up a retail store for your clientele. So bulk pricing does not exist, period. And essentially, when we build an online store, now we don't charge for online stores. We build them for free. We have no issues with that. But there is an upfront, basically, like I let them all know, hey, you need to sell 24 pieces for the store to go through. You can only have one design on three products. So you can take a design, put it on a long sleeve, a t-shirt, and a hoodie. And you have to sell at least 24 of those. And I'm going to make the prices. And essentially what I tell them is when you build an online store, you're going direct to consumer. So the parent that's checking out for their kid, they're looking at a shirt and saying, okay, it's $15, $16, $17. It doesn't matter all that much. And so because you're giving them a retail experience, you're charging retail pricing. On the flip side of that, there's also a ton of work on the backside of the store as far as collapsing it, bagging and tagging it, and the customer service involved if something happens. Because you are going direct to consumer, you are responsible for every shirt, making sure that it makes it to every single customer. And it's on you if you don't successfully do that. And so with that being said, that is why I dictate prices and why I charge quite a bit when I do them. Now, if a customer will say, well, I think we're going to order 100, I tell them, do it the first time. And if you do that a couple times, we'll knock your pricing down. But we don't let them have bulk quantity pricing. when it comes to online store. There's just too much risk involved. That's my answer.
No, are you splitting that pricing at all? Are you like giving them a portion of that?
So if they want to fundraise or fundraise, that's totally on them. So if I tell them, hey, the shirts are going to be $15, they can say, put them at 20 and they can make $5 a shirt. That's their business, not mine. Only thing I take is a transaction fee, just because you don't want to lose money on credit card fees. But that's completely on them. Now, on stores that are really good, so clients that are running them once a month, sometimes I'll incentivize them and say, hey, guys, if you're able to sell 400 pieces, I'll bump this up a couple bucks a shirt to make you guys more money. And you'll kind of backwards incentivize them. But I only have a few that I really do that with because they're trained on my system. So short and long of it, online stores are a profit center. But you have to treat them like that and sell them like a premium service. It is not a Dunkin' Donuts value meal thing you're selling. It is a premium experience.
Gosh, damn, we're never getting a Dunkin' Donuts sponsorship now.
Dang it. Krispy Kreme's better anyways. That's fine.
How do you handle the upcharges? Because I remember you always talked about we individually bag regardless of it being a pickup or delivery. Is it $1? Is it $2? Like, what are these add-ons?
They're not add-ons. They're just retail pricing. Like,
so it's included with everything?
It's included. We do not give the option. Bagging and tagging is you must do it. Because I'm not going to assume that the group organizer knows how to bag and tag. Okay? Shops across the country are messaging us saying, how do you bag and tag? Like, it's a very, you have to do it and be very careful about it. If I give it to a parent to do, they're going to call me back and say, we're short two smalls. Well, I'm going to burn 3 more screens to get them 2 more shirts, and that's going to take 2 hours, and that's what it would have taken to bag and tag the order. So we know that we're going to bag and tag it perfectly with our system, and I've got a YouTube video out there on how to bag and tag perfectly. And when we do that, we don't get any calls or issues, and we almost train our customers to know that's our style. So if you get an online store, it's going to be bagged and tagged. And that's the name of the game.
Okay, where can people start, though, with the price? So is it like a 12-shirt order with finishing and everything? Is that a good starting place and then go up from there?
What you would sell 12 shirts at.
Okay.
And the other thing I say is if a customer tells you how many they think are going to sell, divide that number in half.
Yeah, they have no idea. Everyone thinks they have the best idea and that they're the best salespeople, and then unfortunately, it's not always the case. The hard part, too, is if you're setting that standard of saying, like, hey, you must sell 12, you must sell 24, and they don't hit that number, you're now having to go in and say, okay, refund, and you have to either charge them for the credit card fees that have happened, right? So now you're leaving a bad experience for that user, right? Your customer. So Steven has a lot of things that I've actually taken and kind of stolen those ideas from, of letting them know out front, okay, you must sell these minimums, and then checking in a couple days before the store ends with a reminder, you are under what you need, or hey, you're golden, keep doing what you're doing, no worries. But giving them enough time to go, okay, I'm six shirts short, let me go ahead and I'll just go buy those 6 shirts to make sure everything goes through, whatever the case might be. But making sure you have constant communication, which again, you're having to put a lot of work into this to be successful. If you're not charging for that time as well, well, now you're not making money doing other tasks you can be doing. So I think Steven's exactly right. You have to be charging at that real price to be delivering this whole experience.
The other thing that I'm doing is I'm co-marketing. So I am the marketing expert per se in the situation, and I'm asking them how they're delivering the message to their customers. If they're just going to post it on Facebook once, big red flag. I'm asking for an email list and saying, are you guys emailing this out? If you're going to be emailing it out, it's going to be over 10 days. You need to send one on the first day, middle day, and last day. And I'm using Printavo statuses to basically say your store is doing well or your store hasn't hit minimums. The other thing that we started doing is a store approval. So with unlimited automations and approvals, you can essentially build everything out on a Printavo quote, put in the customer notes, you know, things about the store, create a message that says these are the 10 rules of the store, and make sure they hit approve. Once they hit approve, we build that store instantly. So a lot of customer education through the process. So that we avoid, you know, those problems that you talked about, Matt.
There's a lot of setup. I mean, you're listing off just some of the things here, but do you charge for setup? I've heard some people do some sort of fee, or that's the part of the baked in premium per item that it's hope to make later.
We say like frictionless sales, right? How do we get a product to a store to a customer as quickly as possible, like cutting through butter? And if we can avoid as much friction, that's fine, as long as we do a good job educating our customer. So if a customer has failed on their first store, we're probably not going to build them another one without having a conversation. But you know, the other rule we say is if a store fails, we refund it instantly. We don't extend it. We don't allow them to do anything with it. It's canceled. And all of the customers will get a message saying, please talk to your group organizer if you'd like to try this order again. It's not our problem.
Got it. So, and while we're on this topic, late orders, and this comes up a lot too, people, the store closes. If it's a, you know, I don't know, a very loyal customer, someone that spends a lot of money.
I mean, we've had like park districts, like park district kids where it's like the next day. And if we haven't hit press, if it's still before it's hit press, I'll pass and protect the store, turn it back on and say, you got like 20 minutes, get it in there. We'll get that order through. If I've already copied it over to an invoice and it's already hit press, it's too late. It's done. That's not on me. That's where, again, it's on the group organizer to make sure that they're getting everything they need.
Yeah. What we do is we say the store closes Sunday at midnight, but Milo will actually close them like Monday at 10 a.m. to let any trickle come through. And if someone will message us in that time, it's Milo's call. 95% of the time she says no, just because it damages the person that bought first. And that's what I tell the group is when I extend a store by 1 hour, it actually like disincentivizes buying early. And so you're rewarding the person that procrastinated and you're delaying, you know, potentially delaying the order to the person that bought day one. So it's not fair. And we're pretty strong about it and we don't really stray from it because it's wrong.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I've also done that I'd recommend for folks that are trying to get into more merch stores, and this merch store approval that Steven talked about, I also stole this concept from him. Very, very big help. But one thing I've done is I've actually created a template status. So I've got Printavo template, and so when I look for that status, I find a couple just like fake orders. I have myself set as the customer, but in the customer notes, I've got exactly what my expectations are for that merch store laid out with literal underscore areas where I have to fill in the blank data, then go ahead and make the quote and send it over, right? So every time I'm actually creating this merch quote, I don't have to go through and type out or go find and copy and paste that data I want to have in the customer notes section. It's already there. I just fill in the blanks and shoot it out. I've actually started doing that for other Printavo uses too, but that's a big help when it comes to quickly getting a merch approval out to a customer.
I love this topic. I could talk about merch all day.
I know. That's why I figured
literally,
this was
actually,
be,
I was in the shower this morning thinking about it.
About merch?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking about this morning. And I was like, why is merch so great? Because merch is your best marketing tool. Merch like exponentially like creates a larger reach for your shop. So if you want to market
because
more
of the customer emails,
it's exponential. Yeah, literally like you go from 1 to 20 per order, like 20x on terms of like leads and prospecting and getting contacts and stuff. You could not
enough shops do that though. I talk to shops all the time, at least 2-3 a week, where they'll have a store successful. They'll have like 100 sales. I'm like, okay, have you retargeted? Like, well, what do you mean? I'm like, you have to go export this list of people who purchased. You have their emails. You should be reaching out to them, emailing them, thanking them for their purchase to the store, adding them to your weekly newsletter, asking them if they need any other merch needs. Retarget that audience. And people are like, oh, I didn't think of that.
I mean, even if you don't and you just insert a stuffer in every bag, you're still marketing. You're still doing something. But it's literally exponential. And people always ask, like, what's the best way to market or get more customers? Merch stores. Literally 20-1 as far as like B2B to, and you can now convert those merch customers into B2B customers. Happens all the time. Don't snooze on it.
That's awesome. Yeah. That's super interesting. Have you ever taken that to any Facebook advertising or targeting, or is that like too much? It's easier for the low hanging fruit on the flyers and email.
We spend very little on Facebook ads unless we're running a retail brand like, you know, Jute Mode kind of does and John Amato's helping us. But we don't do a lot of it. we are collecting so many good emails. We just rely on email marketing.
Sure. And it's basically free.
Mm-hmm.
Got it. All right. I got the timer on here. We got 3 minutes left. I got an interesting story I wanted to share with you guys, actually.
Was that the second question? Wasn't there two questions, though? There was a two-parter. I think that was the first part you asked. Was that both parts?
No, that was it.
Okay.
I mean, we went into like 3-4 topics there.
All right.
Matt wants another question. Guys, can you guys go ahead and write Matt a question?
Podcast, it's got to be technical. Like, talk about mesh. He likes talking about mesh.
Mesh or seps or anything
mesh counts.
All right, we'll get you a good question, Matt. I'll find you. I'll ask around.
He wants to get real nerdy about some additives.
I can talk about that, like you can talk about merch, yeah.
Have you guys heard of a guy named Lawrence Herbert?
I want to. That's a great name. I do not know that person, though.
Okay, so obviously everybody's heard of the Pantone book. He is the guy that invented the Pantone book. And this is a little quick aside here to wrap up as an interesting story. But basically, he owned a printing company in the 1960s, and he was doing a lot of painting. And so he got so frustrated with all the different colors that were so similar. And of course, people were like, you know, I want the blue, I want the red, right? And of course, that can mean anything. And so what he did was he created a standard that he gave out to his customers, kind of like what you have, Steven, on the wall, like that poster that's like, here's our standard.
Swatch card.
Yes. 20 colors, whatever. And he gave it to every single vendor that he could find. And that's what he called the Pantone book, which of course continued to grow over the next 50, 60 years. To a point where, you know, every company, even Ben and Jerry's, uses it for their brownie colors and ice cream and for QA testing. And it's actually $100 million business a year of selling
books. Yeah, it's $200 a book. That's why.
Exactly. And of course, they update it constantly, too, with all the new colors. But I think the whole story goes back into how they created their own standard that became just an international, you know, well, standard, right? And just how long that actually took. I mean, that was probably 40 plus years of continually handing out that book. And I'm sure there's others that have tried to do this too, but I found that just background very fascinating. I never knew that was such a large business. Obviously, that book is so expensive, but pretty cool. I heard it on a separate podcast, actually.
Do you think he likes hex codes?
I think he's very anti-hex code. Lawrence Herbert is a very old gentleman. You can search for him.
Yeah, I was just on the Google.
I'm going to become friends with Lawrence Herbert. His name and his background are all I need. We're going to become besties.
It's just interesting on the standards of fixing their problems. And granted, you know, obviously, I'm sure they don't paint or anything anymore, and this is their pure business. But of having to standardize and fix their problems. It just kind of reminded me of the 2-second lean and constantly thinking about how do we 1% improve what we're doing.
Yeah, I have. So I read the book you sent me, by the way, and then I bought the audiobook and I've been re-listening to the book.
Which one?
The 2-second lean. I like it. He gets a little bit too, like, when he brings it home and he's talking about like his making his coffee or his tea in the morning, I'm just like, all right, you didn't have to do any of that, in my opinion. Like, the stuff at work all makes sense and I love it. Like the wheels, the Windex, like all that stuff.
Matt, but if you labeled your bathtub with a fill line, you wouldn't have floods.
That cut deep.
If you guys didn't listen too real.
Last week's episode, Matt had a severe waterfall feature coming from his ceiling.
A little unintentional water feature is not necessarily a bad thing. And now we've got a nice big opened aired ceiling with it just cut open. You can see the pipe. So now it's easier to get to. I just got to put some new drywall up at some point.
All right, guys, we're jumping in. We're really excited to bring on Tom Round from Envision Tees. He's got so much to talk about. Thank you guys for joining the pre-show. Take a listen. All right, guys, welcome back to the podcast. We've got Tom Round from Envision Tees, from 1-800-T-Shirts, from real estate stuff. Do you have a real estate company name, Tom?
Yeah, just Round Real Estate. And then the new one is Fast Food Landlord.
Round Real Estate, Fast Food Landlord. I'm writing all this down.
Bruce, that was not the intro we needed.
Hold on one second.
I was talking to Bruce on Sunday, Tom, and I'm like, I think if we could give an award to someone for the most interesting screen printer man of the year, it would be Tom Rowan. So that's what I'm awarding you today.
Why is that?
Because I don't think there's something you don't do, and I'm very much like, I think there's a twin, or there's got to be like 10 of you, but I just see you running like 100-mile trail runs, buying Arby's, 1-800 t-shirts, running breweries and a print shop, and you shirt lab, and you still manage to like answer us on Facebook when we're like, hey, can you look into this order for us? And I'm just like, there's got to be a clone or something. But I'm like, how the heck do you do this all? And
that is a great intro.
Can we start with that?
We're going to use that one, actually. Chris, just use that one.
Tom, can you show us your clones, please? Like, you can pan the room.
So one of the secret weapons is my wife. She keeps me in line and kind of keeps everything together. But, you know, part of it when I'm running and training for these 100-mile races, I typically wake up about 5 a.m. and I'll run anywhere from 10 to 20 miles a day. And during that time, I basically like go through in my head, clear out like everything that's like junk, and then get like really focused on what needs to be done that day. And then just have an amazing team. So everything from the sales department to production and to the multiple businesses, we've got great team members that, you know, the hardest part I think I have is taking my ideas and everything that's going on here and projecting it out to the rest of the team, and letting them kind of run with it. So I'm big on just like, once I get those ideas out and whatever the game plan is to them, letting them run and not micromanaging and not like being too hands-on on like everything else.
So like, I was reading about Elon Musk and how he plans his week out between Tesla, Boring Company, SpaceX. How do you budget out? Because you do a ton of different things. How do you like? What's a week in the life of Tom Rowan like?
I need to work on that. So there's not less necessarily like a time budget for each area. It's more of just like throughout the day. I might be pulled into several different directions. So throughout the day, I'm wearing a lot of different hats. And some days it's different than others. Kind of just depends like what has higher priorities or what maybe has a bigger fire that we have to put out.
Is the thought about diversification from a business side, or is it like, first of all, super hats off, because as Steven said, I can't imagine running a separate business right now. And maybe that's just a testament to not having all of the different management pieces maybe that's needed to do that. But, you know, what is the thought process around? Is it like, I just want more streams of revenue, or I just want to diversify from apparel? I mean, there's a lot here.
I think like the core of it is I'm a creator and I like creating different experiences. I like creating different things. And it keeps my mind busy because I'm not like on the same area all the time. I'm looking at, because they're like completely different markets, completely different customer bases. Like every part of these businesses are different. So, you know, whether it's a brewery or the limo company or the real estate,
there's or a the limo company
event side of things.
Hold on.
Or just like the running, like they're all different.
There's a limo company. We didn't know about that.
Actually, a lot of fun.
Who's driving?
Not me. So the funniest part about that is my driving record. I am not allowed to actually drive any of the limos because of insurance reasons. So that's the best part about it.
Too many red light tickets.
This guy runs 100 miles. He has no business driving a limousine.
Yeah. Like, I'll meet you guys there. So, like, shops and people listening to this are always, like, saying, like, I'm losing my mind running my shop. It's, like, putting out fires one after the other. Talk about how you – I mean, you obviously have an amazing team around you, and I think that's a testament to having the freedom to do whatever you want. What was it like assembling that team? Because until you can automate one thing, you can't really go to the next without losing your mind. Do you have, like, you know, assistants that are working around you? How much time are you spent, like, training people? Like, talk to us about your people, like, around you. Because I think that's huge.
Yeah, so that's a work in progress. We're constantly, you know, we've had some turnover. So, you know, we're constantly filling some holes and looking at better ways to train, implement systems and processes and stuff like that. And that's, like, not – I'm, like, more visionary side. So that isn't even, like, my process of thinking, like, okay, how can we get all these steps down and stuff like that? So, you know, it's kind of like – it's hard to explain, but, you know, once you get, like, some momentum going, then it makes it a little bit easier. But it's still a challenge. Like, there's not a day goes by that we're not either putting out a fire, trying to plug a hole, or just, you know, trying to improve something that we're currently doing. So, yeah, I'm definitely not out of the weeds yet. I mean, there's still a lot of days where I might be jumping back on a press and printing. But while I'm printing, I might be, you know, watching a webinar, or I might be, you know, knocking out some phone calls while I'm printing. So still in the weeds, still doing a lot of hands-on stuff. But at the same time, like, have a lot of people, you know, handling things too.
But, like, let's say somebody did want to start something else, a brewing company, for example. Do you have a partner that's also helping to do a lot more of the operational aspects there?
So with the brewery, I've got an amazing partner, Jeff, and he's managing partner, handles all the day-to-day. We've got a great taproom manager. Our brewers are absolutely phenomenal. So, you know, I give them, like, 100% of the credit there. I'm very hands off on the brewery operation, help out mm-hmm. with, you know, some marketing, PR,
tasting,
you know, matching stuff up with some of the relationships I already have. But for the most part, like, they're just amazing team down there.
Is it safe to say that you are more of an investor then in a lot of these different areas, and Envision Tees helps fund that?
Yeah, I would definitely say, yeah, in a lot of areas, it's more of an investor and advisor role than, like, hands-on on the day-to-day in some of these.
Yeah, because, I mean, you would call yourself, like, a serial entrepreneur, right? Whether it's fast food or a limo company or a brewery, you know, Bruce and I keep talking about this Traction book, and there's the visionaries and the integrators. Is that Traction, Bruce, I think? I guess, like... Yeah. It sounds like what I'm hearing is, like, you surround yourself by a lot of really good implementation and integrators, and you can be the visionary. And I think when you have to do both, it's like a handcuffed experience. It's not something that you're able to do and take to fruition. I guess, like, let's talk about, you know, like, something like the limo company. Is that something where you're like, I saw it as an opportunity, it's profitable, it's lucrative, you put it in motion, put someone on it, and they run with it? Like, how Yes. does that work?
Yeah, 100%. So it was something I saw as an opportunity. A friend of mine, he was actually looking at the same opportunity. I called him up and I was like, hey, I've got this idea. He's like, holy crap, I've actually been looking at the exact same thing. So he's running everything 100%. Basically, I'm there as, you know, advising, you know, lending marketing expertise, marketing, putting connections together of clients for the company and things like that. So, you know, on the day to day, Aaron's running everything and I'm just there to help out and, you know, help point it in the right direction.
Wow. So then, like, from a finance standpoint, you know, I don't see you flying around in your jet yet, but Are you very much on the ground with the finance side of things, like pushing numbers, looking at reports? Like, do you have a strong, like, are you a strong in accounting? Because I feel like a lot of what you're, these are big number games that you're playing, you know?
I am not very strong on accounting, especially like on the, on like a lot of the like ground level stuff, but at a high level, like I can look at stuff, say, all right, this is good, this will work. Especially on the real estate side of things, I've got that down really well. And then, you know, just looking at it and seeing that it makes sense and everything else, and then identifying either like some weak points or pain points or like areas that we have to switch or adjust. But as far as like diving into the numbers and getting real deep on them, that is definitely not my strong suit.
Gotcha. So do you have like a board of advisors or just like someone in your life that's like crazy good at it that you just lean on or what?
Yeah.
Do you want to share them?
Yeah. I mean, it's basically our accountant, and bookkeeper. So, but we are looking now, you know, as there's multiple things going on and as everything continues to grow, adding a board of advisors, that is multifaceted. So it's with, you know, someone like someone with a banking relationship, someone on the accounting side of things, someone with more of a financial analysis, things like that, where, as a small business, like we can't afford to hire all those people on our team, but if they can take a high level look at stuff on a quarterly basis, as an advisor, that would help a ton.
Which, Tom, which business is most profitable? Feel free to.
With limos, of course.
Party bus. Like, what? And maybe, I guess, maybe there's like a percentage aspect and there's just total profits, which maybe envisioned because that seems to funnel the rest of it. But, you know, are there any interesting hidden gems here?
Yeah. The, I think all of them are more profitable than the t-shirt business.
All right. There we have it, folks.
They all vary so much because it varies from products and services, you know? So like the limo company is a service, like the overhead is just completely different. The brewery, you know, it is different too, because you got the tap room and we're going full retail. We're not really wholesaling out as much to other bars and restaurants and like grocery stores and stuff like that. So we're getting the full margin. And there's just so many moving parts with the t-shirt business. So I feel like on t-shirt business, I met Perry Marshall, the king of 80-20, and he basically said, like, if you really dove into the numbers on your t-shirt business, there's probably 30% of the stuff that you're sending out the door, you're probably losing money on. Another 20%, you're maybe breaking even on. And then another 30%, you're making low money. And your top 20% is like where you're actually making some money. So he's like, if you can cut off the bottom 50%, just focus on that top 50. That's where you become super profitable in the t-shirt business. So we're looking at that and saying, all right, I mean, we all know orders like, we do, and it's like, holy crap, I don't think I made any money on that order. All right, I lost money. I always say, like, we just paid that customer basically to do this order.
Amen. And we heard, like, Mark Coudre talk about that. I was actually at a shop yesterday, the guys at Rowboat gave all of our students a tour because they just do cooler stuff than us. And, I mean, their runs are massive, and they were showing us sim process, 8-color sim process, and 1,000, 2,000 piece runs. And we were out to dinner after, and they asked me, like, Steven, can we do that? And I'm like, trying to get it through their heads that, you know, an 8-color sim process on their 75 fraternity shirts just doesn't pay the bills unless you charge $35 a shirt. And I think we want to do all the coolest things in our industry, but at scale, you can't. You physically can't. Tom, you've bought out some shops, right? Like, I think you've had a bunch of acquisitions. We've been kind of watching in our industry shops shuttering lately, some big shops closing, small shops closing. Talk to us about that, because you kind of, like, as you grew in vision, you ate up other shops along the way. Talk to us about the acquisition process, because I think that's super interesting.
Okay, so we've acquired 6 other shops in the last 7 years. and they've ranged in size from doing $400,000 in revenue to $2 million in revenue. And it's a lot of different moving parts, a lot of different scenarios. People are always asked, like, what are things you've learned? I've learned a lot of the good, the bad, and the ugly with acquisitions. I think the biggest thing I can share on those is you want two definite things to align. One, the equipment. If there's equipment involved, if you have all M&R presses and the shop you're acquiring has anything but M&R, then like that just doesn't align and you're going up with a mess. Same goes on the embroidery machines. If they have Baradin or Tajima, you need those things to align, or like you're just going to end up selling that equipment at whatever the, you know, used price is and getting that out of the way. So that's just like a lot of extra things. So you want the equipment to align in with what you're currently doing. The other thing is you want the customer base to align with what you're currently doing, unless you're trying to like get into a whole new market. So the ones we've found that worked out really well are the other owners that have the same values and beliefs that we do, because a lot of times the client base is attracted to the owner, and the way that they do business, if that aligns with the way that you do business, then it's easier to keep those customers on board longer and, you know, get that transition.
So did they become your employees, or did in those situations, do they walk away from the business? Like, how did that play out?
So one of them, we kept the facility open and there was about 25 employees, and we kept it open for 3 years until we moved into our bigger facility. Then we combined both under one roof. They were about 4.5 hours apart, so none of the employees stayed on after that. We, you know, helped them, you know, find new positions and things and other shops around the area. Other ones, a lot of them were smaller, where it was a person retiring or they were just getting tired and getting out of the business, where it was like a 1 to 3 person shop. So it's basically they were just closing down and getting out of the business.
Wow.
How do you value those businesses? Is it like EBITDA times 1.5, or how does that work?
They're all very different. So you put a little bit on equipment inventory, and then really look at the top 50 clients and what like their average order amount is, what their annual spend is, and value it really on those, because you're going to lose, especially if, unless they're located in the exact same town, because some of them we've acquired have been in other states, and unless it's like in your same town, like you're going to lose some of those smaller accounts, like, you know, Joe's Lawn Care and whatever, Lions Club and things like that, because like they just want to be local and true to, you know, whoever they're, the guy is down the street on the corner. So they're not, they might not go or stay with a new company that's, you know, across the state or a couple states away.
Is 50% a safe number to say you're going to lose off the business revenue wise from this transition?
Yes. Yeah,
is
for
that
sure.
Under, I mean, or over, or yeah, right about right?
Because if you look, and that's why we only look at the top, you know, the top 20 to 30%, or the top 20 to 50 customers, because that's where like the meat is of most of the revenue anyway. So if you can keep the majority of the revenue from those top clients, depending on the size of the company, it might be the top 50, it might be the top 100. Like that's what you're acquiring. Those are the long, those are what I call relationship clients that are, you know, it might be a bank or an insurance company or, a franchise or something that's got multiple locations, a lumber yard, something like that, where those clients have been with that company for, you know, 10 or 15 years, and they're going to continue to, they value that relationship. Versus a transactional client. And a transactional client is a bachelorette party, a one-time event, grandma coming in and getting whatever, you know, those types of things. So you're going to lose the transactional clients that are just like maybe once a year, once every 3 years, once every 5 years. But you want to keep the ones that are relationship-based, where they're ordering, you know, on a monthly or quarterly basis.
So, like, Tom, you talk a lot about the type of customers. You know, do you guys do something different or special at Envision to really analyze your customers, whether that's like using a CRM or, you know, every month actually looking through who are repeat customers? Like, are there tangibles that your sales team does? Because it sounds like you guys are very laser focused on that customer type, and that's what fuels you.
Right now we're working on dialing in. So it used to be, you know, a big net of doing anything and everything for everyone. And so now we're dialing in of, you know, who are our top five, you know, target markets, and really focusing on that top, you know, top tier of who are our top 100 clients. Because if you lose a client that's doing $100,000 with you a year, or even 50, it takes a ton of small one-time transactional, you know, $200 to $300 orders to make up for that one client.
Totally.
So, you know, focusing on those long-term clients that are bringing in a lot of continual revenue is really a big focus.
That's interesting. You talk about shaving off the bottom, though. How do you really plan on doing that? Is it a lot? I think people want to, but in practice, it's a little bit tricky. I mean, it is money, and, you know, people talk about raising prices to try to help shave it off or make it profitable. What is your strategy?
Right now it's raising prices on the bottom. So, you know, raising prices on the bottom until it is profitable. Like, sometimes I think in our heads, we negotiate against ourselves and think like, oh my gosh, I don't think they would pay that, or
yeah,
I don't know if I can charge. I don't know if I can charge that. But really, the value is there. Like, we need to do that. And I look at it in other industries. So if you think about the big concrete company that's like in your city, like, they're doing the highways and they're doing like the parking lots and stuff at the universities and things like that. Like, if you call that concrete company, it's like, hey, I need a little sidewalk done in front of my house from my driveway to my front door. Can you guys get me a quote on that and come out and do that? Like, most are just going to say no. Like, that's like, they just can't afford to do that because it's costing me that too much. Or if they were, they'd be like, all right, for that little sidewalk, that 10 feet of sidewalk is going to be like 10 grand, right? Like, it's got to be enough to make it worth for their crew to do that, because that's taking their crew away from resources that they could be doing on a multi-million dollar project. Now, the same works for t-shirts, right? So the time and resources of your salesperson, your art department, your purchasing and receiving of doing a 6-piece order takes away all those resources from the opportunity to potentially do a 500 or 1,000 piece order. And it's the same amount of time of entering that paperwork and collecting the money and doing the ordering on the 6-piece orders as on the 1,000 piece order.
So then, you know, let's talk a little bit about 1-800 t-shirts, because that's kind of a custom ink style model of really being out there. You know, there's a How I Built This on 1-800 Got Junk. That's an amazing podcast. Kind of sounds like you're trying to do something like that a little bit. Talk to us about 1-800 t-shirts, because we've been hearing about it, seeing you with it. It's always in your backgrounds.
Yeah. And how'd you get it, too?
So we're working on launching it. It's kind of a slow launch. You see the co-branding right now with Envision. So right now we're going to be doing a rollout of a Shopify store, full e-commerce, and hopefully getting out here before the fourth quarter is the goal. And yeah, kind of just blowing some things up from there. So right now, you know, we're basically just a landing page and, you know, capturing leads and things like that. But once we get the e-commerce up, that's kind of our next phase of scaling up. How did we acquire it? So that was a 5-year process. And so Frank Newton with Newton Screen Printing, he had owned it for, I believe, 40 years.
Frank, the visionary.
Yeah, so he had owned the domain and the phone number for 40 years, but they always operated as Newton Screen Printing. So they never used it as a brand or a marketing side of the business. It was just happened to be their 800 number that they used. And, you know, I see this as a marketing person and totally was like, oh my God, this is the best marketing real estate in the industry. And so I reached out to Frank in 2015 and I still have the email in 2015 and said, hey, I'm interested in acquiring your domain, phone number, business, whatever it is. Are you interested in talking about that? And he emailed me back and said, not at this moment. I'm going to retire in 2020 and it'll be, you know, for sale at that point.
Set the reminder.
So no, it was not set the reminder. It was build the relationship. So from that point, basically every 6 months from 2015 until last year, I reached out, whether it was sending them something in the mail, a letter, giving them a phone call, shooting them an email, touching base, and, you know, building that relationship, learning more about their business, learning more about their customer base, and just building some trust and everything with them. So when 2020 came along, you know, Frank is like ready to retire. And I'm like, holy crap, we're going through a pandemic. But we had planned this for so long that the wheels were still in motion to do the acquisition. So part of that was through building that relationship over a 5-year period, I was first in line, you know, for it. It wasn't, you know, publicly offered up there for sale where, you know, the Custom Inks and some of these other big brands of the world that have a lot of venture capital behind it, they could have snapped this up in a heartbeat and it would have been a line item on their marketing budget. Like it wouldn't have even been a blip on the radar for them. So we're very fortunate to be able to, you know, make that acquisition and work with them. And, you know, now we've, you know, integrated all their customers into, you know, our sales team and things like that and just continue to move it forward.
What did it cost? I think that's the burning question.
Probably not as much as you think. It was a sizable investment, I'll say that. But you know, I think it was a win-win for both.
Is the future then phone? Is that like why there's such a big push of having the name B100, 1-800 T-shirts? Like you really think that so many more people are going to be on the phone and it's going to build customer service? I mean, we feel very strongly about phone, but I'm curious on your thoughts.
I don't know if it's as much as like the future of being phone, but I think just the brand recognition, you know, you see 1-800 Flowers, 1-800 Got Junk, and they've built great brands around that. And so we're looking at some things that we can do to mimic what they're doing. We've looked at, you know, the possibilities of adding, you know, kind of a larger network of licensees under the 1-800 T-shirt brand, similar to like 1-800 Flowers, where they've got local flower shops throughout the United States that use the 1-800 Flowers number. Could we do a similar model with 1-800 T-shirts with partnering with shops from throughout the United States to give it a local feel, but then much more on a larger national scale when it comes to marketing and promoting?
You guys received the Inc. 5000 award. I know you were pushing on it a bunch. Steven, you guys did too. I guess we're not supposed
to talk
about it.
Bruce didn't fill out the application.
No, we just did too because I needed help hiring, and I think it helps legitimize the brand. And so we did it as well and just qualified. What was your guys' thoughts behind that? Is that something more people should do to help? Is it a hiring thing? Is it just a customer, you know, social proof thing?
I think it definitely helps social proof. It helps with hiring. I think for the team, you know, it's kind of a, you know, what is our Super Bowl trophy or how do we get to the finish line type of thing? So it definitely helps on that. And it helps to set a goal. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's, you know, from Inc. Magazine, which is a publishing company. So they want eyeballs. And once you win the award, you realize they want to sell you like the license and the rights to use that name and to promote it and everything else. So it's kind of like the Guinness Book of World Records. Like there's a publishing company behind it and they want PR, they want publicity, and getting that Inc. magazine and the Inc. name out there with these businesses, like, is just as much a promotion for their company and their brand as it is for yours. So, you know, if you see the back end of it, there's stuff that goes along with it, but it's highly prestigious. If you look at the number of other businesses that, you know, you're surrounded with in there, and it kind of is the who's who of, like, what businesses are hot right now, who's growing a ton type of thing. So I think that's absolutely phenomenal. And then we went to the conference in 2019, and super inspirational to be around other entrepreneurs and business owners that are just really scaling things up and growing their businesses. And they had an amazing track of speakers and, you know, people that you can meet and stuff like that. So that was a phenomenal experience. And we did it 3 years in a row. Last year we were down in 2020, but we're shooting up pretty high this year. So I'm hoping next year we make the list again, and we'll keep applying.
Yeah. And it's one of those things where if you're going to do it, you have to lean into it, you know, kind of like you're saying is you can probably get it, and there's certain revenues you have to hit and things like that. But after that, yeah, there's some pay to play for sure. I mean, it's not cheap to go to these conferences. They don't just fly you down there. Even to use their like marks and stuff, it costs money. But if you use it the right way, you can flex with it for sure. And if you can get one or two orders while you're down there at the conference and make a couple contacts, you pay for the trip. You know, we did it, and I think I did it too early. And then I got scared by all the other stuff that came after it. And they're like, we want you to pay for this and this and this. I'm like, what the heck? But, you know, like, Tom, you spend a lot of time, you know, networking at conferences, in industry, out of industry. You know, I guess, like, when did that light bulb go off for you that that's a huge part of you, at least from what I see?
So that was a huge game changer in our business. And I think that was probably around like year seven or eight into the business. Right now we're at year 16, so about the halfway point of starting. And it was when, like, I was in my office and I'm looking at my competitors and stuff like that, and I'm like, all right, I'm doing the artwork, I'm doing a lot of like stuff here behind the computer, I'm back on the press. Like, I need to get out of the office and meet people, whether that's locally at chamber events and other like networking events, or just being like present in the community, volunteering, being on boards, going to festivals, whatever it is. And then even beyond that, like traveling and seeing what others are doing and making some of these connections face to face, and getting out of like the shop. And like, once I started doing that, I was like, I had this mindset like, oh my gosh, like, how are things going to keep going? Or is that going to hurt the business? But the moment I did, like, everything started taking off, because as you know, like, in this industry, word of mouth is so valuable and so big. And then, you know, as you make those connections and you meet some, it's amazing. Like, you meet somebody in, you know, I travel to Arizona or somewhere, and I meet somebody at a bar or at the airport or at the convention or wherever, and a month later we're doing t-shirts for them. And then the next thing I know, like, we send them the shirts, and then they tell their friend about it, or somebody sees them, and like that spider web that like spawns out from that ripple effect is just unbelievable. So like, that has been a huge part of our growth.
And we joke about, like, Kevin Baumgart spent some time scripting and working with my team. I think Tommy spent some time with you, and he goes, you guys are in a weird industry because sales just come to you. He's like, you're so fortunate. And it's like, well, we are our best salespeople. You know, like, I think you look at some of these shops and how they got there, and they look back and they're like, they just became like butterflies. And I think that goes to show, you know, if you want to grow your sales, there's not a magic pill that you take or a Facebook ad that you run. But I think it's truly like getting out there and stepping away from your shop. I think, you know, you obviously run screen print marketing, and there's a lot of hacks and things that you can do. But at the end of the day, you know, like, being present, it just sounds like you are everywhere. And that's why you're able to be successful at what you do. And I think that's awesome. Bruce, what about you? Because you didn't go to trade shows for a minute. And then you started.
I was anti-trade show, actually, for a minute, to be more accurate. No, nothing against the MBM and Impressions folks. Thank you guys so much for the great booth positioning. but yeah, no, they're just so expensive. And as a small company, you know, it's $8,000 a show for a 10 by 10 booth, all in, travel, hotel, booth, Wi-Fi, rugs, electric, so on, so on, sparkling water. And, but I figured, you know, we're in the age of the internet. Why can't I just advertise online or email or so on, so on? And, you know, I couldn't be more wrong. I mean, people like doing business with you, A, because 50% is because you could just do the service that they're looking for. And then the rest is because they just like you and working with you. And, you know, you treat them like, you listen to them and you're there for them and you're the expert, right? The more I think that any company can help foster that, the better, because honestly, the bar is low for that. I feel like you probably deal with a company or a store or anything that has terrible customer service almost every week. And maybe it's not terrible. I shouldn't say that, but it's okay. Like, the bar is so low that just by making somebody feel special, I don't even, like, a water bottle when they walk in or anything like that, really just creates a memory in their head and creates that special bond.
Relationships are back. Can't swipe right on sales.
No, the bots, the chat bots, it's like, just pick up the phone. The amount of times we've honestly gotten a sale because someone was looking for shop management software and we just were there on the phone to answer.
No, people want to talk to people.
It's insane.
People want to talk to people. Tom, something I want to ask you about, there's this concept in business called, like, finite and infinite games, basically, you know, gratification in business. Being a long distance runner, and you also playing games in business that take a long time to play out. 1-800-T-Shirts is happened 2015, and you're still saying, like, it's still a work in progress. It sounds like you're not, like, instant gratification or winning tomorrow is not your priority. And I think that goes to show on all the irons that you have in the fire. How do you measure, like, the success of all the different things you have going on, knowing that there's a very long game to everything you play?
Yeah. I mean, it's looking at the long term, like, and that's where I said with our customers, it's relationship based and not transactional. So it is, what is in it for the long haul? You know, we want this customer for life. We're not going to go anywhere tomorrow in any of the business, like the real estate stuff that we're doing. Some of these leases are 10 or 20 years. Like, that is a long time that we know, like, we're going to be in that project for. So it's always looking, like, at the future, looking long term. And not, you know, what's going on tomorrow, the next day. But also with that, like, we're looking and saying, like, okay, I've got two kids now that are 3 years old and 5 years old. Like, how does this look? And so some of our decisions now are, like, how does this impact on the family side of things? And, you know, when they're in high school or when they're in middle school, what we do now, how is that going to impact those ages and what we're doing and what I'm doing in business at that time in their life as well. So, you know, I think it kind of comes and goes in seasons, and, you know, it's looking, but then also looking down the road 3 years, 5 years, 10 years and saying, okay, what does that look like? And if we keep doing what we're currently doing, is that going to change the trajectory of where things are down the road, or what, like, big changes, or what do we need to shift and do differently so it aligns with everything else as we keep moving forward?
And I think that's there's some irony there. There was, like, a conversation about real estate in one of the groups, and, like, should I buy my building? And I think it might have been you or someone that said, like, think about 10 years from now when your building's paid off, you know, or you're going to have something that you can sell. And I think as small business owners, when we get into the shop, we're like, how do I get profitable this year? How do I grow to this much? And I think in your eyes, you're looking at it as, I'm throwing a lot of darts. What's gonna be good 10 years down the line? That's going to give me, you know, a little wealth from here and here and here. And I think that's a very mature and hard thing to do in business, especially me being younger. And we, you know, as much as we give you shit for all the different things we do, that's a pretty hard mental game to play. And I think if shops are listening to that, that's something they should take away from Tom, is like, he plays long games. It's not about tomorrow, you know? Yeah.
Go Tom. Yeah. I mean, it's the same as training and running a 100-mile race. So like, if you decide you're going to do that, you're not just going to go out tomorrow and do it. You know, like, it's going to take a long time to train and get to that end, like, gratification, and a lot of work to get there. And people always ask, like, how do you get to, like, how do you run 100 miles? I'm like, just 1 mile at a time. I start off my training, like, I go out and run 2 miles, and then the next day I run three. And then, like, you keep building up over the course of that whole training period. And the same goes in business. They're like, how do you get, you know, 4 automatics and 50 heads of embroidery and, like, you know, all this stuff. And I'm like, well, I started off on it with a manual press, and, you know, and you keep progressing, like, one t-shirt at a time, like, one, or like, you just keep adding on. And so you can't look at it and say, like, oh my God. And I see this a lot, like, a lot of small printers who are like, how do I get this 10,000 or 20,000 piece order? And I remember our first one, it was an absolute nightmare. And even now, like, with the logistics we have, it's a lot of work, and it takes it. Those, like, aren't even fun orders to do anymore. And so it's always like, don't try to shoot for that finish line, like, too early. You're going to get there, but it takes a process and it takes a time. And know that you got to put in the reps and the work, and you'll get to that finish line, and you have to find little rewards along the way.
It's awesome.
Boom.
Well, Tom Round, the 100-mile man. This is awesome. This is action-packed. I really, really enjoyed it today. Thank you so, so much for taking the time to chat. This will be an awesome episode when it drops.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate you.
Yeah, thank you, guys. Thanks so much for listening to the Print Hustlers Podcast. We'll see you guys next week. Thank you, guys, for listening. Thank you, Tom. Have a good one.
See ya.